experts on everything from weapons maintenance to leadership to how to stop homesickness. "Hey, sir, when's the mail coming?" kids would ask again and again. I'd take a hike out to the 3rd Platoon outpost, which was under construction. I'd have a look at the rebuilding and then just sit there thinking, if I were the enemy CO, how would I attack this position? I did the same thing down at the Gap. Then I would war game all the options. How would I maneuver? Where would I set up my supporting weapons? What would be my main attack? When I penetrated, how would I roll up the flanks? Out of all this pondering, night after night, came our defensive organization and local counterattack plans. Every time I walked the line, I'd find troopers asleep. Sleeping on the front was a court-martial offense. One snoozer weakens the whole defense. But I didn't believe in court-martials. There's more than one way to keep people awake, and I preferred the old Army NCO way. Company procedure required anyone coming up to the trench to be softly challenged. "Halt, who goes there?" No challenge generally meant the trooper was asleep, or at least not doing his job. I'd sneak up and toss the guy on the trench or bunker floor. He'd wake up with my trench knife against his throat. If I were a North Korean, you'd be one dead son of a bitch. Then I'd bring in the chain of command, so every responsible leader got into the act. I'd call in the kid's squad and platoon leaders and, on the spot, have them explain why he was sleeping. But I knew why. A lot of troopers could sleep all day long and still nod off on the line. It was their escape. Many were so damn scared they'd fall asleep just to make it all go away. But sleepers placed the rest of my soldiers at unnecessary risk, so alertness became top priority. NCOs and officers started patrolling their sectors like cops on a beat. This cut the number of sleeping incidences way down, but there were still too many offenders. Finally, I came up with the ultimate punishment. Habitual sleepers would man the outposts. Nobody would dare screw off there. It's only fair to say that from time to time I fell victim to the Sandman too. One night during the first week, I'd done my walk through the position and returned to my CP running on empty, afraid to even grab a catnap in case something happened and I'd be too foggy to deal with it. I sat down on my ammo box and air mattress bed. I couldn't lie down. Lying down meant instant sleep. Should have kept Joe Love's commo wire contraption, I thought as I lit another cigarette. That bed virtually guaranteed sleepless nights. I'd chain-smoked from the minute I came inside the CP, and between the smoke and the heat from our little squad stove, my bloodshot eyes were beginning to sag. I got up and poured my millionth cup of black coffee, which had been reheated for about the 2 millionth time since dinner. I sat down again, thinking that my breath would kill an elephant, and closed my eyes. I woke with a fright. The sun was just rising. "Adkins!" My commo-com operations sergeant appeared at the doorway. "What's happening with the patrol?" He gave me a puzzled look. "Sir, you brought it in an hour ago." Adkins had thought I'd been resting my eyes. The whole time I'd been sitting there, he'd been bopping in and out, saying stuff like, "The patrol is at checkpoint red. Shall I move it according to plan to checkpoint blue?" Apparently, each time I'd pondered the question and then issued clear instructions. But I had no recall. Sound asleep, I'd just moved the patrol all over no man's land and home again. Not cool. From that moment onward, I made Adkins have me on my feet every time I gave such instructions. In the meantime, I thought with great misgivings, all's well that ends well, and wondered if I should assign myself to OP duty too. Total U.S. casualties for the Korean police action as of 10 November 1952 were KIA 21,471, WIA 89,263, MIA 10,793, and POW 1,868. A lot of numbers, a lot of good men. Gold stars, purple hearts, and broken-hearted families. A couple of the most recent WIAs were mine. We got an extra ration of incoming the day they did their tallying, and the night of the 10th, 3rd Platoon was caught in a 20-minute torrential downpour of accurate MG fire from No Name mixed with the usual mortar and artillery fire. It started inexplicably and stopped just as quickly. We tended our wounded and all was quiet. The 11th, my birthday, was a day like every other, only a bit colder. At dusk, my patrol men were chomping at the bit, waiting for the shot of first dark to send them dashing off to the valley floor. This is how the war went. During the day, both great armies lived underground, hoping not to get knocked off by the unrelenting bursts of artillery and mortar fire coming from across the way. At night, the war moved into the valley, where small, lightly equipped patrols hunted each other down in no man's land. The key to the ambush patrols was to beat the Reds down to the choice ambush positions. Most sites, like the Pines, a favorite just north of the gap where the boys were going tonight, were no bigger than a city parking lot with only limited places to set up. The patrol would then set up a killing zone with all-around security in the hope, ideally, of taking a prisoner before dawn's first light. Accepting the work of U.S. Raider-type units, to date, the enemy had been far craftier and usually more successful at this sort of operation than the average American doughfoot. Basically, this was because, among the other good things the North Koreans were lacking, was rotation, an insidious system that caused U.S. troopers to pay more attention to counting days than fighting Reds, and to make not even the slightest attempt to get to know the lay of the land. A crucial element in staying ahead in this war. The North Koreans, on the other hand, knew every fold and wrinkle of the battlefield as well as a game warden knows his reserve. They'd been there since the beginning, and they'd be there for the duration, unless they went out feet first. This fact alone gave them a decided advantage, the motivation for taking the job seriously. Dark came, and out went the patrol. I'd stay in my CP ready to pour in the supporting fires until the men reached their layup position. I thought about Colonel Locke, who'd paid his daily visit that morning. That was the only bitch I had about the great, relatively safe road network that ran behind our position. As a result of it, we got hots for breakfast and dinner, no complaints there, but we also got many, too many sightseers. Every visiting fireman seemed to come to fighter, mainly because we were so accessible, completely destroying any chance of sleep during the day. The road ran but a few steps from our CP, and out of the jeeps they'd hop, fat politicians in new green fatigues and high muckamucks complete with entourage from regiment, division, corps, and army directly into a well-constructed bunker. They'd take a quick look at the enemy positions from my OP, pile back into their vehicles, and get to the rear just in time, I assumed, for happy hour. Locke's visits, however, were somewhat different. He usually walked the trenches before coming to the CP, casting his old army eyes over everyone and everything. Hearts throughout the company would freeze with fear. It took till the next morning to thaw them out, and by then he was on his way up the line again. He was an odd guy, Locke. His attention to discipline and exacting detail no doubt saved a lot of lives, but I didn't agree, nor would I ever, that fear was the only way to get results. This morning, for some reason, the troops had been spared. The colonel had come directly to the CP and flopped down on my rack. How he was able to do this without wrinkling his starched, immaculate uniform, I'd never know. We'd talked about the company, the battalion, and the other world out there. I'd been amazed at how cynical he was. Then, as usual, we'd taken a walk down the long tunnel that led to my OP. About halfway, there was a small step down, and as usual, I said, "Now watch your step, Colonel." He'd missed the step, which was also as usual, thumped his head on a supporting beam, and cut loose with the foulest tirade imaginable in my direction. "You goddamn motherfucking rotten son of a bitch bastard of a pissant lieutenant! Why don't you fix that fucking step?" That had been just the start, and as usual, Locke's assessment of fighter's old man was broadcast for miles to both friend and foe alike. I'd just "yes, sir'd" and "no, sir'd" until the barrage slowed down, only then reminding him, as usual, about the 2-ton rock that lived under the step, and that to modify the tunnel fell into the category of building the Hoover Dam. Thinking about it now, I had to laugh. Locke had skinned his head this morning. Pretty soon his skull would be as worn down as his teeth. The patrol reported in from the first checkpoint. Negative. Nothing in the pines, at least not yet, and no enemy in sight. Then, just as I was about to leave the CP, a huge wall of enemy fire crashed over the company sector from end to end. I ran to my OP. It looked like the 4th of July out there, with artillery, mortar, and direct fire MGs blazing in the meanest barrage I'd ever seen. I called for all flash fires to lock our position in. If we were getting hit, the enemy attack force would be out in the open now. We could smash them with our counter wall of fire. The platoons had flipped on their radios. All reported heavy incoming but no ground attack, though 3rd Platoon leader Joe Stokes had just lost contact with his outpost. He said he'd send some people out to check on it as soon as the worst of the present barrage ceased. In the meantime, our patrol at the Pines had seen no enemy movement. I told these men to sit tight and try to avoid making contact. I only wanted one ball game at a time. Stokes reported contact, infantry force, size unknown, on his reverse slope. They weren't in his trench line, he'd had no penetration and didn't know where they'd come from. The other platoons still had no contact when I called Locke with a sit rep. He said E Company had been penetrated, which at least answered the question of where the North Koreans were coming from, but it had been a damn gutsy maneuver on the enemy's part. They had to have come up right through their supporting fires. I had our FO lift the defensive fire everywhere along the company front except 3rd Platoon, and I took off for Stokes' position. In their first real fight, my boys, God bless them, were cool, alert, and professional. Squad and platoon leaders moved back and forth, checking their positions. Troops challenged me right down the line. We passed through 2nd Platoon and entered 3rd Platoon's trenches. It was a whole different scene at the top of the hill. Total panic. The boys had bunched up, leaving large areas of the trench abandoned. Mortar and artillery fire was still raining down. MG slugs were stitching the top layer of sandbags. The Humpty Dumpty bunkers that hadn't yet been rebuilt were taking fire right through the apertures. The guys inside were pinned down and couldn't return fire. I suddenly realized that was what the barrage the previous night had been all about. The North Koreans had been zeroing. Clever bastards. I ran over to the E Company tie-in point. The penetration had come at Easy's first fighting bunker. Enemy tracks in the wet ground ran right over the top of it. My guys got themselves together and sealed the penetration. We could hear a good firefight raging on the reverse slope near Stokes's CP. No one had a clue as to how many bad guys were down there, but at least now they had no way out. I went inside the E Company bunker, only to find a certified frontline recreation center. A poncho was over the aperture. Candles were burning. Magazines and playing cards were strewn all over the place. And in the middle of it all were the bodies of 2 Americans who died having fun on the firing line. Stokes appeared, steady and very much in control in his first big firefight. He was a good man, Joe Stokes. I'd liked him from day one. He'd graduated from Oklahoma A&M in agriculture the year after Barney K. Neal. His father had destroyed his dreams of turning their panhandle plot into a prosperous farm by finding oil all over the joint. Stokes had actually been disappointed. Now he reported in, with his dry sense of humor, that gooks were still alive and well on the reverse slope, but being contained and whittled down to a size, with a dozen enemy dead already. He said there were no friendly KIA, but at least 10 wounded, and he'd still had no word from the OP. I told him to clean up the reverse slope. I'd go down to the OP myself as soon as the incoming lightened up. Stokes moved out while I directed the weapons platoon leader to get tank, recoilless rifle, and 50 caliber fire onto No Name to shut off the goddamned MG fire still ripping right into the position, and I organized a squad of Stokes's people under PFC Lindemann, a great former 1st Cav combat man we'd picked up as a replacement, to check on the OP. I finally had a chance to touch base with my CP. The patrol still had no contact. I told Adkins to return these men to the main line and have Joe Rice meet them at the patrol gate in front of 1st Platoon. No doubt the boys below would be a little trigger-happy with so much action just up the ridge, but if Rice was out there, He'd make damn certain that weapons remained locked and the patrol not be chopped up by jittery friendlies. In the middle of all this, Lindemann appeared with a struggling Katusa and dropped him at my feet. This yellow little bastard was on the OP. He saw the gooks coming and bugged out. The Katusa was crying. Everyone under Pancho. Every night one guard. Same. Me. I see enemy come. I run away. The rage built up so fast I didn't know what I was doing. Stuck in the trench wall was an M1 cleaning rod, all metal. Without thinking, I grabbed it and lashed out at the Korean. I picked him up and threw him over the trench. He'd lead us through the bullets to the OP and whipped him with that cleaning rod until he got his cowardly weaponless ass moving. It was another page in the continuing unfortunate saga of the Katusas. Through attrition, their numbers had dwindled as the war dragged on, and they'd become less and less effective as their untrained ranks continued to be integrated into American units, leading naturally to more and more resentment among their U.S. counterparts. It wasn't until a short time after this fight when I put all the Koreans in one unit under a great little Korean liaison sergeant-turned-line NCO named Chung and got results that I finally understood how much of the damn problem was the Yanks themselves. Most American leaders had given up trying to communicate with the Katusas, except through sign language, more often than not obscene, and name-calling. The war had made all the UN troops cannon fodder, but the Katusas were treated like subhuman cannon fodder. The Americans came and went every 9 months. It was the Katusas who stayed on these slopes for the duration, and as time passed, we, the Americans, were the ones who, through the continued introduction of green EM, and in most cases even greener officers, were becoming increasingly less proficient in our trade. It should have been little wonder that the South Korean soldiers were cool, cunning, and more adept at keeping their heads down than joining in the fray. No wonder in a jam that they'd save their own asses and not their U.S. buddies. But I was too mad to think about that now. We arrived at the outpost to find two men dead, bayoneted, and their throats slit. The third man, Haley, was missing, and the enemy long gone. The OP had been taken by stealth and surprise. There were no spent cartridges to be seen, just long gray ashes from cigarettes that hadn't died as quickly as their smokers. The poncho lay crumpled at the bottom of the hole, a picture worth a thousand words. Haley and the two KIA had been sleepers. I ordered Stokes to make them permanent OP until they got their shit together. They must have thought school was out when they covered the foxhole with that poncho and lit up. I spent the rest of the night with Lindemann and his squad searching for the missing man in no man's land. We went all the way down to the valley floor, which was still being pulverized by U.S. artillery fire, but Haley was nowhere to be seen. Fresh tracks gave us the first clue as to the size of the raiding enemy force. 2, maybe 3 platoons. It was getting light, so we gave up the search, and with heavy hearts moved back to the OP to pick up the dead and take them to our lines. By the time I got back to 3rd Platoon, the enemy dead had been searched and neatly stacked like sacks of potatoes. The North Koreans had put on a good show, even if they'd lost 2 dozen men. They'd knocked off the OP and taken a prisoner. They'd sneaked up the hill and slipped right through the weakest and most critical point in a defensive position, the tie-in point between 2 separate units, and swept undetected over the reverse slope. Only now did I find it was just the North Koreans' bad luck that 10 of Stokes's men were leaving a sleeping bunker to relieve some buddies online at the same time the enemy appeared on the scene, that I'd come up and closed the penetration behind them, and that the beautifully detailed map of our position, both fighting and rear, which undoubtedly had been made with inside information, probably one of the Korean laborers was a spy, and which we found on one of the dead, was a direct replica not of our position, but of Joe Love's when we'd relieved him 2 weeks before. The major lessons learned concerned sleepers, smokers, and sloppy procedures. Henceforth, following the lead of Red Smalling in the Easy Company days, sleepers would have the shit beat out of them by their leaders. Cigarettes, which could be seen for miles, were as good as an engraved invitation to the enemy to come and get me. So from that moment forward, smoking was prohibited from sunset to sunrise anywhere on the hill. The rule applied to chain-smoking me, too, and there were to be no exceptions, even within the deepest, safest bunkers on the reverse slope. Transgressors would meet the same fate as the sleepers. It had been sloppy not to inspect the easy company tie-in position every time we checked our line. If I'd been the third platoon leader, I was sure I would have done so. At least I thought I would, but as company commander, I definitely should have, so this was as much my fault as Stokes's. Henceforth, though, it would be the rule. We also placed tactical barbed wire complete with mines and flares along our reverse slope boundary with E Company. This caused quite a row between me and the easy CO, but I wouldn't bend. I was rarely burned more than once. During the attack, the guys of 3rd Platoon had bunched up, 5 and 6 guys in bunkers designed for 2. It was a natural herd instinct I'd seen a million times, but it might have been prevented had a local counterattack force been appointed the moment we got on the hill and the guys trained accordingly. It should have been SOP. Instead, more sloppiness on both Stokes's and my parts, and worse for me because I should have known better. After the wounded had been evacuated, I went back to my CP to record the action, the mistakes, the casualties, the lessons learned. My little book would be a valuable teaching aid. I'd go over it with the troops, and when we got into reserve, we'd go over it again, again, and again. But I did not write down my own mistakes. I didn't have to. For all the work we'd done, for how on top of things I'd been feeling that such a thing should happen, and why, I was sick, guilty, and ashamed. My own lesson learned was indelibly etched in my brain. The image of 2 dead soldiers whom I'd known were irresponsible, yet whom I'd tasked with the safety of my unit. I'd violated security and sent them to their deaths. Haley, the 3rd man, was the only soldier ever captured from my command. He was released some months later as part of Operation Little Switch, but the tragic, unnecessary losses, a direct result of the worst command decision I would ever make, were crosses I would bear for the rest of my life. Happy birthday, Hack. How's it feel to be 22? Other documents found on the KIA with the map, he'd most likely been the CO of the raiding party, caused higher headquarters to believe a major North Korean attack was imminent. Nothing came of it, but it was good psychological warfare, compliments of the enemy. Sometimes these sorts of documents had exact dates and times which kept us on our toes and higher-ups milling around the position. In the meantime, we rebuilt and reorganized, starting with the piss tubes the 11 November North Korean raiders hand-grenaded out in what was probably the only humorous moment of the whole affair. We used metal 105 ammo canisters both for stovepipes and urinals. The piss tubes were dug into gravel pits with lime all around them and were interspersed with the stovepipes of the sleeping and warning bunkers throughout the platoon's reverse slope positions. The North Koreans must have been drilled that a tube sticking out of the ground meant a stove, which in turn meant a bunker, which meant throw a grenade down there and blow it all up. Stokes had seen one gook send down a grenade only to have it blow up at his feet, killing him instantly and showering him with Yankee piss. Guess the North Koreans didn't know Indian folklore. American braves always said the white man pissed too close to his own teepee. We absorbed new replacements, many of whom were combat-ready for a change. I had a lock on good people through Boyd Guttery, who'd left as one of fighters' platoon leaders to be the regimental personnel officer. He was a good man I'd fought to keep when he was ordered back, though I'd lost that battle. I'd won the war because Boyd sent us the best. Former Trieste studs like Sergeant First Class Sewell and PFC McGuire, as well as airborne ranger types, Korean returnees like Lindemann, and my favorites of them all, good old country boys from the hills of Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia, who, unlike all the city boys, had grown up with a weapon in their hands and took to combat like Alvin York. Danny Forrester from Tennessee was one of these. He was absolutely fearless, and with him, ex-187th man Bob Gruber, and Uno Rentmeister, an ex-82nd man who reminded me of Jimmy Miyamura. He could walk through unpacked snow without leaving a trace. I had the basis for the best of fighters' recon patrol teams. Uno Rentmeister was probably the deadliest weapon fighter had against the North Koreans, basically because unlike the National Guardsmen and draftees in the company, he believed. Uno had grown up in Estonia. As a child, he'd seen what the Russians did to his homeland and that of the neighboring Finns, and at 20, he hated all communists and what they represented. "I felt a little bit different than a lot of the guys," Uno would say years later. "I volunteered to go to Korea and fight the communists, and most of the draftees were thinking about going home. But that's why I'm here, and so many of them are buried." Uno was a small guy, completely at home in the dark, snowy woods. He knew how to dress lightly, and was able to train his fellow patrolmen in this and other subtleties of the dangerous recon work. For example, not to open candy bar wrappers on patrol, as one uninitiated member did one night, the paper crackling like thunder in the Silent Valley. The two biggest problems Uno ever had were the night I sent him back to the rear to get a good night's sleep. He found a few guys sleeping in a tent full of litters, commandeered a vacant one for himself, and in the morning awoke when two guys from grave registration started carrying his bed away. He unwittingly spent the night in the regimental morgue, and the Puerto Ricans in his squad who disobeyed his orders on the pretext that they couldn't understand Uno's second language, English. But in the case of the Puerto Ricans, that was just one of the excuses in one of the squads. Nobody had an easy time with these particular islanders. The Puerto Rican contingent of the company, like the Catooses, had proved virtually ineffective as individuals fighting alongside their mainland counterparts. They got spooked at night and caused the same major disciplinary problems within Fighter as they had when I'd first encountered them on the ship coming over for this tour. Then they'd had big chips on their shoulders because their Puerto Rican regiment, the 65th Infantry, had been broken up. So much for the Army's quest for integration. The voyage from Puerto Rico had been marked by complete anarchy. The Puerto Rican NCOs had no authority, and every day saw another punch-out or some kind of problem, with the troublemakers, who in fact were running the whole damn ship, traveling in gangs, isolating a few whites and doing a job on them. I'd been assigned as mess officer for the San Francisco-Pusan leg of the trip. I knew nothing about the job, but you didn't have to be too smart to see that serving chow to 2,500 men under gang rule was impossible. As the Puerto Ricans steadfastly refused to comply with the ship's meal shift schedule, with the troop CO's blessing, I let the word go forth. You will eat by compartment, as the ship was divided for control purposes, or you will not eat at all. And backed up the ultimatum with a bit of muscle in the form of a dozen tall paratroopers armed with hickory batons. The first day saw numerous skirmishes, but the brig had been readied for immediate occupancy, and the hooligans were off to the slammer before they knew what hit them. It didn't take long to get back on schedule. The only problem was that the ringleaders were still at large. Then I found out they were scrounging like crazy from the ship's store and the crew mess. Like squirrels getting ready for a long winter, they were storing rations for the trip so they wouldn't have to play by my rules. I got the store closed and the mess secured, and by the end of the second day on board, the battle of the midsection seemed won. Until the third day. Luckily, we'd been tipped off by an old Puerto Rican NCO. My paratroopers were in perfect riot control formation when two dozen bad guys launched a bold attack right down the steps leading to the mess. Order was quickly restored, and the well-thumped leaders of the gang spent the rest of the trip in the brig nursing their wounds. In fighter company, it was pretty obvious that all the energy these Puerto Ricans used up fighting the gringos would be better spent fighting the enemy across the valley. But they needed a leader to bolster their confidence and give them some self-esteem. A Puerto Rican sergeant named Rivera, who joined us through the replacement system, was the one. He'd made a combat jump with the 187th Airborne RCT on a previous tour. White, black, Puerto Rican, or green, that was no small thing. And under his leadership, the new Puerto Rican platoon, which wasn't nearly platoon-sized, but it sounded good, became a great fighting force almost overnight, just as the Koreans became under Sergeant Chung. Sometimes all the motivation a guy needs is a little respect and a damn good leader who shares common ground. Even before the big influx of replacements, the leaders I'd inherited had begun to show their true, capable colors. Gregory, my top, was damn smart and growing into his position every day. Fighters' platoon sergeants, Hudson, Allison, and Smith, were magic on patrol and doing fine with their acting master sergeant roles, too. Though I had no power to promote, acting or otherwise, above corporal, in the Raiders I'd organized promotions for Jimmy Miyamura and other deserving guys through Colonel Sloan, I got the stripes and had the guys sew them on as if they were the real thing. Authorized, permanent stripes did come down from regiment each month, so over time, in fighter, the guys would, one by one, start getting paid in accordance with what they were wearing on their sleeves. But in the meantime, my acting promotion scheme worked wonders. Within days, each man and his respective unit were functioning like they'd been at it for months. We were not the best yet, but we were getting there. The sterner the challenge, said Toynbee, the finer the response. And it impressed the visitors, too, to see all these senior NCOs in one little company. But we were still a bit green in the great scheme of things, so I was elated when Colonel Locke rang to say he was sending me his sergeant major. I couldn't believe my luck. I remembered the guy. He was a young parachute master sergeant, a walking recruitment poster. Great, I said. I'll make him my first sergeant. Nope, replied Locke. I want him busted. He's no goddamned good. I'm sending him to you because you're the hardest guy I've got. I want him to be a private within a month. Bust him for inefficiency. A few hours later, a short, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, all-American stud by the name of John Westmoreland walked into my CP. I explained to him that the colonel wanted his stripes and asked why he was on Locke's shit list. Well, sir, Westmoreland began with a wonderful Tennessee twang, you know, the colonel has a mighty wild temper, and went on to tell me it had all started the day before when Locke's field telephone at Battalion CP wouldn't work. The colonel had flown into a rage and thrown down the phone. It broke. He'd snapped at Westy to get him another one, and though Westy was not the commo sergeant, far be it from him to disobey an order during a tantrum. The second phone hadn't worked either, and according to Westy, Locke had gotten so mad he'd taken a swing at his sergeant major. But Westmoreland, who'd been middleweight champ of the 82nd Airborne Division, had just stepped back and cleaned Locke's clock. In the middle of the command bunker with the rest of the CP group sitting at ringside, I now understood why Locke wanted him reduced. I also knew I'd do everything in my power to make sure it didn't happen. The colonel had had the right idea to send Westy to the line, but he'd picked the wrong CO to bust his ass. The challenge was just too great to resist. Westmoreland had no infantry experience. He'd been trained as a medic and worked his way up to sergeant major of a medical battalion at Fort Bragg before being transferred to our infantry unit. But he was very sharp, and I could tell he was a good man. So the first thing I did, with his consent, was make him an assistant squad leader. This was three big steps down for a master sergeant, but the guy was willing. I told him I'd work with him and instruct his platoon leader and sergeant to do the same. The fact was, I'd been down the same road myself. In both the Recon and George companies, someone had always seen potential and taken me under his wing, but I'd had to prove myself on the ground before I got any real responsibility. I'd continued the tradition in the Raiders. N.G. Bill Smith got a lot of attention from the rest of us, and he'd proved himself a fine young leader. Like Smith, Westy had all the makings. He just needed the techniques. So every night when I walked the line, I made a point of seeing him in his squad sector. I'd fight him through hypothetical attacks, deploying mythical men and machine guns until he got a feel for the game. Most of it was common sense anyway. Westy was just one more act to juggle. In many ways, the easiest, because he was alert and eager to learn. Maybe it was because he'd been a medic. He had an intuitive understanding of the tides of battle and a heightened sensitivity to the needs of his fellow troopers, and that was far more than could be said for many men, both on the line and at the regimental country club. During this period, we found ourselves inundated with inspectors. The only good reason I could find for this was that higher headquarters had nothing else to do, The stagnant Korean War presented many problems for the Army, not least of which was a whole bunch of rear echelon staff officers working in headquarters that were designed to move, but with nowhere to move to. So these officers were made inspectors, and then sent traipsing off to the trenches to look at the way we lived. And for morale purposes, I guess, they were supposed to help us. Not only did they inspect our food, our bunkers, and our weapons, they inspected our teeth, too. Yes, dentists would visit the frontline positions and wake troopers who'd been up all night pulling guard or on patrol to examine their teeth. That kind of help we didn't need. Morale could have been lifted far better if they just stayed away and let us sleep. Another innovation in this trench war was the Korean Certificate of Loss, KCL. We were told that Congress, concerned about Army waste, had adopted the KCL as a watchdog mechanism. Anything that was lost in the trenches or in combat with a value of $50 or more had to be accounted for by a certificate signed by the company, battalion, and regimental COs. Not only did this mean an enormous amount of paperwork at the company level, the last thing we needed as we attempted to fight a war, but it also made liars out of us all. In Fighter, we blamed, for example, the problems of a six-man patrol for the loss of more gear than would be carried by a platoon, including the otherwise unexplainable disappearance of two kitchen fire units. Even the regimental COs knew this. From time to time, our KCLs were sent back with a note to find a better story to cover a loss unacceptable under the KCL rules. How this was supposed to jibe with an officer's integrity, I didn't know. From Congress to the boys in the trenches, the war had become a useless drain, not just of resources, but of credibility. And why the higher-ups didn't just end the thing was beyond everyone's comprehension. The first snow came on 17 November. Unlike the previous Korea winters, we were well-equipped, warm as toast with cold weather gear, including experimental pocket warmers and lightweight, bulkless 8-pound armor vests that a .38 slug wouldn't penetrate. The latter reduced casualties and kept chests, backs, and guts warm. It was SOP to wear them on the hill 24 hours a day. The cold weather was, in a way, a blessing. It made the ground like concrete and really reduced old bunker collapses. It also solved a lot of our sanitation problems. The decaying flesh along the wire froze up, and without the usual revolting stench, the rats found it a less appetizing target. We still had rats, of course, but were slowly winning the battle through our rat poison campaign. For my own CP, though, I had a simpler, more straightforward solution. Lying in my sack, I'd watch the huge bastards scampering along the logs over my head. I'd lead on their tails, which would dangle over the side of the logs, and, with a little Kentucky windage, blow them away with my .38. The scheme worked well on two counts. I greased a lot of rodents, and few people entered my side of the bunker unannounced. With the cold as well came more incoming and more enemy probes. It seemed as if the North Koreans were making one last effort before the real winter set in. Only then would they go to ground and more or less hibernate for the season. But the boys, who were getting better every day on the line, weathered it all, including the same savage hand-to-hand combat against probes that made it through the barbed wire. One morning, Locke rang. "What is the situation with Westmoreland?" 30 days to the minute, the son of a bitch, I thought. "Working on it, sir, working on it," I told him. "Things have been a little rough up here." The colonel accepted this, and I bought a little more time for the inefficient ex-sergeant major who, with no outside influence from me, had already been promoted to squad leader. The other item on Locke's agenda was the barbed wire. Higher headquarters wanted it cleaned up. So did I assured him, but hadn't figured out a way to do it without getting people killed, and I'd been delaying making a decision until the frost. The colonel decided the time had come and said he was sending up his ammunition and pioneer platoon to get started. The pioneers arrived, none too pleased about this duty. The next thing I heard was that their platoon leader was refusing to go out with his troops. I coaxed him out myself at rifle point and assigned one of my guys to keep him there. Meanwhile, the Pioneer's platoon sergeant, a hot-blooded Italian stud, was snarling that it was the stupidest idea he'd ever seen, and he was right. First Sergeant Gregory had calculated that Fighter was the 11th company to occupy this position. The wire defenses were 11 generations worth of mines, booby traps, and as many Rube Goldberg-like explosive devices as ingenious American teenagers could devise. It was a bad, bad place, which would have been better left alone. The Pioneer sergeant went down to battalion to protest, warning that someone would be killed. He was told to press on. The mission prevailed. Back on the line, he was so pissed off he began stomping through the field, screaming, "If they want mines, I'll find their motherfucking mines!" One of the fighter's fine squad leaders, Sergeant Simmons, a black stud and damn good man who was providing the Pioneers with the security detail, had a hell of a time reasoning the guy out of blowing himself up. Good, calm Simmons got the senseless operation going again. Ironically, he also stopped it once and for all when he tripped a U.S. hand grenade booby trap while helping an entangled Pioneer. Simmons's face was not touched, but the blast took off the back of his head, splattering his brains around for yards. "Forget the mine clearing," came the word from second bat, and the Italian Pioneer sergeant shook a clenched fist in the direction of the battalion CP, shouting, "Fuck you! Fuck you all!" Losing men to friendlies was always a bitter pill to swallow, but when it happened through sheer carelessness, it was enough to make you ready to kill. Sometime after the minefield incident, Sergeant Louis Bravo, a great brave parachute sergeant, found his fighter patrol stuck out in no man's land, the two outposts having heard enemy activity along both withdrawal routes in our sector. In the end, I told him to bypass fighter entirely. After he finished the patrol, he should come up through G Company instead. I rang the CO of George, explained the situation, and asked him to alert his people that my guys would be coming through about 0500. He assured me he would. When 0500 came, as did Bravo's patrol, one of the George OPs opened fire on them. Two men were killed as Bravo screamed, "Hold your fire! Hold your fire!" As soon as I heard, I called George 6. "Your OP is firing at my people. Did you notify them?" "Why, yes, I did," he said, which was a lie, as we later found out from the George OP sergeant. "Perhaps they panicked and thought they were under fire." "Well, shut it off," I screamed. "We just took two dead." "Pity," George 6 replied in a cool, even voice. "Pity, pity, pity." By now, I'd organized a group of good shooters to act as a sniper unit. They were excused from night duty and spent their daylight hours surveying the enemy trenches with damn good scopes mounted on 50-caliber MGs and rifles. To give my CP group a chance to be part of the action, I'd placed one of the sniper positions on top of our CP bunker under camouflage-painted burlap. Now, at first light, the morning of the Bravo patrol, I felt like going up there, turning the rifle around, and blasting George 6's head right off his shoulders. I didn't, of course, but I should have. As it turned out, it might have saved another man's life. In late November, the Assistant Division Commander, Brigadier General Gordon B. Rogers, visited the company. I took him through the little tunnel out to my OP to have a look at No Name. Then he went back to the CP and drank coffee until there was a let-up in the somewhat heavier-than-usual afternoon shower of incoming. As soon as the steel rain stopped, he ran out to the road, got into his jeep, and drove away. A few weeks later, the Daily Dispatch included a general order, GO, awarding this very general a Silver Star. Since the date was the same as the day he'd visited Fighter, I read the GO with interest. Apparently, Rogers had, with great courage and utter disregard for his own personal safety, exposed himself to sustained enemy artillery and mortar fire over open terrain while personally inspecting frontline positions. Well, I thought to myself, maybe he'd put something in his coffee I didn't know about. I kept reading the GO, trying to figure out exactly what he'd done, on the assumption that this was not a load of shit, but that perhaps he'd visited another unit that day in which he didn't spend the whole time hunkering down in a safe CP, to deserve the third highest combat decoration the U.S. Army awards. So far, he hadn't done one thing under any worse conditions than my platoon leaders and NCOs, or for that matter, every swinging dick in the company, didn't do 24 hours a day, every day of the week. Then I found it. The presence of a general officer in an area that was being continually shelled was an inspiration to all troops. Now I understood. Stripes and bars just don't dazzle like stars. It wasn't what you did, but what you wore on your shoulders when you did it. My revelation was not quite accurate, as it turned out. For about the same time, word came quietly down that all battalion commanders were to get a Silver Star for something, too. Joe Rice was asked to sign a statement that Colonel Locke had come into his platoon CP under heavy and deadly fire. A quiet but serious fuss transpired when Joe refused, but somehow all the awards went through, with each battalion CO showing great courage and personal disregard for his own safety, each exposing himself to sustained enemy artillery and mortar fire over open terrain while inspecting all of his units. This was no mean feat for the 3rd Bat CO, who, the widespread rumor was, had actually been on a boat coming over to Korea on the date he performed so gallantly in action. For field grade officers and above, it seemed as if the awards system had become little more than a giveaway program, Silver Star kisses handed out by higher HQ to recognize these guys spending 5 minutes on the front and getting a speck of dirt on their neatly starched fatigues. Stars and Stripes announced all awards, deserved and other. Once I pinned up the weekly list in my CP when Silver Stars went to a bunch of senior visitors to fighter who, with complete disregard for their own personal dignity, ran through our trenches during a short and not even close mortar barrage right past one of my patrols that had just returned from a balls-to-the-wall firefight in no man's land for which none of the men received even a thank you from higher HQ, much less a valor award. I concluded then and there that the valor decoration awarded to anyone above the rank of captain, unless accompanied by a Purple Heart, was an unearned one, and that the men who took them had a hell of a lot to answer for, not only to their troops, but to themselves when they looked in the mirror. Even putting aside the Silver Star business, as time passed, I'd begun to lose a lot of respect for Colonel Locke. There'd been a postscript of sorts to the mine-clearing exercise over in George Company. Roy Hurt, a West Point platoon leader and fine, fine stud whom I'd have been thrilled to have in my unit, was tasked to take a patrol through an area in no man's land full of uncharted mines. He asked Locke a number of times to reconsider the mission until the area had been cleared, but the colonel was adamant. The result of the action was 3 men blown away by mines. Directly afterward, Locke asked Hurt to make out a report stating that the support engineer detachment had told him the area was cleared of mines. When Hurt refused, Locke said the lieutenant would be court-martialed for dereliction of duty, having knowingly taken his troops into a wall-to-wall minefield. Guys who worked with Locke at battalion said he'd often work himself into such a rage that he actually looked as if he were foaming at the mouth. One of the best stories I heard was of the time Locke chewed out his staff, repeating again and again that they were boys, little boys. During the tirade, the phone rang, and the S2 answered it, "Boys Town, Father Flanagan speaking." The others in the CP thought Locke would hit him. When I heard he'd just stormed out of the room, I figured judgment had prevailed, in light, maybe, of his disastrous duke out with John Westmoreland. And, of course, the colonel was still after Westy. "Working on it, sir, working on it," I said in the most recent of his many calls, not having the heart to tell him that Westy, again with no outside influence from me, was now a platoon sergeant and running his unit brilliantly. One night soon after, Westy led an ambush patrol to the pines where a North Korean patrol walked right into their trap. Westy's force blew them to bits, about 10 enemy KIA and a lot of wounded, and hightailed it home without a single friendly casualty. The next day, Colonel Truman came up from regiment to congratulate the patrolmen and give out some medals. He was impressed with the whole group, but most of all with Westmoreland. He liked the sergeant's attitude and appearance and was knocked out with the perfect condition of his platoon, despite the fact that many of the boys had just gotten back from a 12-hour, very hairy operation. He immediately suggested I recommend Westmoreland for a battlefield commission. I refused, inwardly damning Colonel Locke, whose heat I could feel already. "Sir," I explained to Truman, "it's regimental policy that once an NCO is commissioned, he's transferred out of his unit. Sergeant Westmoreland came here as a medic. He knew nothing about infantry, and we didn't train this fine platoon sergeant ourselves just to lose him to another outfit." "What if I let him stay?" mused Truman. Hallelujah! Unwittingly, he'd executed an ambush as perfect as Westy's. "Then go ahead and commission him." Colonel Locke, as it happened, was on R&R when the paperwork came through a few weeks later. Westy went back to division to have General Cleland pin on his bar. When Locke returned to find a Lieutenant Westmoreland in his midst, he went absolutely crazy. He ground his teeth down another inch and screamed and swore until I was sure a stroke was imminent. When he came up for air, I addressed him as apologetically and sympathetically as I could. "I tried to stop it, sir, but what should I have said? That the sergeant had a fist fight with the colonel and shouldn't be commissioned because he knocked you on your ass?" I might have just been a dumb shit pea brain of a pissant lieutenant, but Colonel Locke had to agree I'd chosen the proper course of action. The weeks went by, the patrols went out, training continued, and casualties decreased. Lieutenant William Price, an OCS graduate, joined us, and I found myself set with good stud platoon leaders and platoon sergeants and squad leaders who were coming along well. It was much easier to build a unit while defending. There was nowhere near the number of leader casualties as you'd get on the attack. As a result, more time was available to concentrate on working with the troops. Even sleepers were learning their lesson. Platoon Sergeant Knock-'em-out Hudson's enthusiastic and ever-bruised fists attested to that. The HUD was a big guy, but small-boned. I always found it hard to match up his little paws with the damage they did to the screw-offs. Sleepers looked as if they'd done a round with Joe Lewis by the time he got through with them. The HUD was not all there, according to some of the guys who knew him well. He boasted that he'd killed his wife, something we were never able to substantiate. It wouldn't have surprised me, though. He seemed capable of anything because nothing seemed to faze him. When a fighter sniper took one right between the horns in one of Hudson's positions, I went down to the 50-caliber bunker where it happened to see what should be done. As Hudson and I looked out the aperture, a slug ripped through the opening, missing our heads by mere inches. I went to ground faster than I think I'd ever done in my life. Hudson, on the other hand, continued staring out the aperture. "Saw that flash, sir," he drawled. Another slug ripped in. Hudson didn't blink. "Get the fuck down, Hudson." "Yes, sir, Lieutenant. I got him pinpointed. I'm gonna get me that sorry son of a bitch. Come on up and have a look." "No way." Hudson shrugged. He carefully sighted the 50 cal. "I've got him in my sights, sir." The gun fired. Hudson turned around. "Got him, sir. You can get up now." I felt pretty sheepish. "At least you're alive," I consoled myself. As for the HUD, well, maybe he was a little crazy, but I preferred to think he just had nerves of steel. Then Homer Smith got into a jam on patrol, but he performed brilliantly, and the next time Colonel Truman trooped the line, he wanted Smitty commissioned, too. He got no complaints from me. Truman really was an enigma to me. He came up to the line, frequently recognized deserving people with awards, and on these occasions seemed to be a great leader. But other times he'd glide through the motions with his great stage presence and prove he just didn't know which end was up. Back in D Company during a formal battalion inspection just before we went online, I'd escorted him through my company area. We'd been up most of the night getting ready. The men looked great, as did our crew-served weapons, which were set up on canvas tarpaulins in front of the troops. All went smoothly through the MG and recoilless rifle platoons, and then we arrived at the mortar platoon. The colonel stopped in front of one of the squads whose 81mm mortar was not set up. Every weapon so far had been assembled on a bipod or tripod. In this case, the bipod was in ordnance for repair, so the tube was laying flat on the canvas. "Soldier," Truman addressed the squad leader, Where is the, he stopped. Where is the, he was desperately searching for the magic word bipod. Colonel Young, standing to his left, did not know the word. Nor, it seemed, did anyone else in Truman's entourage, judging from their quickly paling faces and anxious darting eyes. Finally, the colonel came to his own rescue. Soldier, where is the, holder-upper? It was horrible. The squad members, who had been standing at rigid attention through Truman's struggle, could no longer contain themselves. They burst out laughing while I just looked down at my feet. Luckily, Truman flashed out of there in a big hurry. Once on the line, he stopped a fighter company Jeep driver right in the middle of the impact area on the road to chew his ass for speeding. Who, I asked myself, wouldn't speed in an impact area? The term itself referred to the relentless incoming that clobbered that part of the enemy-observed road day after day, and who with a brain in his head would stop there? Atkinson, the driver, returned to the CP, telling me a colonel had stopped him and taken his driver's license. I told him to forget about it, that I'd put someone to work to organize a new one for him. A few minutes later, the field phone rang. It was Colonel Truman calling to tell me what had transpired on the road. He said he wanted the man in a rifle platoon by sunset, and was completely unmoved by the fact that the soldier had been hit 3 times in a rifle platoon, which was why I'd made him a driver in the first place. It pissed me off. It always did. How guys in the rear used the line as the ultimate threat to make people heal. And as if Atkinson, driving that Jeep and simultaneously dodging mortar and sniper rounds, wasn't on the line enough. I got off the phone. Just don't let him catch you again, I told a very relieved young troop from Kentucky as I asked him what name he wanted on his new driver's license. As for Truman, I'd just have to make sure he was never the wiser. I eventually came to conclude that Truman wanted very much to be a good soldier. The problem was, he'd just been away from troops too long. Once he commanded Roy Hurt to take out a daylight patrol to capture some wounded enemy soldiers reportedly in front of George's lines. Hurt told him it was altogether too dangerous, that the route the patrol would have to take would make it both visible to the enemy and vulnerable to their small arms fire. Truman was not impressed, insisting that the mission go on. As only a day had passed since he'd been threatened with Colonel Locke's court-martial, Hurt figured he had little to lose and took command of the patrol. The group was less than 1,000 yards from George's position when its RTO and point man were each shot in the chest. Artillery support shut down most of the subsequent small arms fire that Roy had predicted. The patrol was still receiving incoming mortar fire when Lieutenant Dave Jennings, then the CO of G, led a relief patrol out to lend a hand. 14 hours later, Jennings was dead, blown in half by a mortar round that missed Hurt by barely a foot. All WIA had been evacuated, and Roy was out in no man's land again, determined to recover Jennings' body before the enemy got to it. He did, and upon his return to the company was told to report to Regimental HQ to receive a Silver Star. To this day, Hurt said years later, I contend that the award was made not so much for any heroism on my part, but to placate the consciences of those who made the inept decision to send the patrol out in the first place. He was probably right, though there was and is no doubt in my mind that Roy Hurt deserved the Silver Star, and more for his almost single-handed salvaging action that horrible day, acting of mortal necessity above and beyond the orders of men who'd long since forgotten if they'd even known the deadly realities at the cutting edge. Whenever I could get permission from battalion, I'd have a turkey shoot. At Benning, they'd call it the Mad Minute, a demonstration designed to show students the Army's available combat power. On position, it served much the same purpose. It gave the troops confidence in our punch, but it also allowed us to test all weapons in a major shootout. On signal, after coordinating with units on our right and left so they wouldn't think the world was falling in, we'd fire every available weapon at the enemy's position, rifles, BARs, MGs, and recoilless rifles, as well as supporting artillery and whatever else was around, like tanks, mortars, and quad 50s. I set out in advance the number of rounds each weapon would fire, so the whole thing was controlled, but for those few deafening minutes, it was the wildest fireworks display you could ever hope to see, with red tracers arching gracefully through majestic Willie Peter and HE shells thundering down. You name it, we had it, and the troops loved it. The turkey shoot also helped rotate ammo, thus ensuring good fresh stuff when we needed it. On top of that, it must have had a pretty devastating psychological effect on the North Koreans across the valley, not to mention the damage it did to any enemy caught roaming around in no man's land. As confidence grew among the troops, so did improvisation. In the daylight hours, where any movement in the trenches brought mortar fire right onto your head, or a dalliance near an aperture of a fighting bunker was an odds-on bet you'd get one between the horns, the troops, besides Uno Rentmeister, who went on rat patrols with his carbine, stayed underground, sleeping, writing letters, and inventing more savage ways of sticking it to the enemy. An old standard by now was the placing of 55-gallon drums of napalm, each with a white phosphorus grenade set in the top as a fuse, in front of each platoon. In an enemy attack, a long wire running back to our lines would be pulled, and the whole jellied mass would go up in a fiery roar, lighting the battlefield like day and denying the enemy even a moment to hotfoot it out of there. Another was the old